We live in the ancestral homeland of a people called the Iowa. Now, two Iowa filmmakers have produced two new documentaries that will introduce us to our predecessors. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Parts 2 and 3 of Lost Nation, The Iowa, premiere this weekend in Iowa City. And this hour, we'll hear some of the stories that keep this culture alive.
You know, among the Iowas, when they were under so much pressure in the early 1800s, the storytelling was part of the survival strategy. I mean, if you didn't know where you came from, you literally could lose your identity.
Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The people who gave our land its name are called the Iowa. At one time, the Iowa controlled the territory between the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, stretching from Pipestone, Minnesota to St. Louis, Missouri. The story of these people is the subject of a series of documentaries called Lost Nation, The Iowa, from filmmakers Kelly and Tammy Rundle of Fourth Wall Films. Parts 2 and 3 of the documentary will premiere in Iowa City tomorrow at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History. You can find out more about that event on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Kelly and Tammy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And it was now over 4 years ago that you released the first documentary in this series, an award-winning documentary. Did you always plan for this to be a series?
We did not. And I suppose that's evident if you view the first film. Although one has to choose what you can focus on, and we were frustrated by that to some degree. And we ended up focusing, though, on a period between 1700 and 1837, 1837 being the time when the Iowa were sort of officially removed from their ancestral lands and placed on a reservation in Kansas.
And how did the idea for continuing this series then come along?
Well, it was suggested really by our audience. Initially, we had suggestions for additional work from the Iowa themselves, who would, you know, were curious to see, well, what else happened, and some, of course, were aware of some of the things that happened that weren't included in the film. So we had suggestions from the Iowa, and then always during the Q&As or discussions that we would have after the, actually, the film has been shown now over 100 times publicly. People would ask, well, what happened, you know, then? And so we realized there was interest in people knowing more about the story, but we were a little concerned about how we would manage to produce another film. I guess that's initially what we thought, maybe one more film from a financial standpoint. The first film was very successful in probably every way except financially, and so we didn't know, but we had a lot of great support, not only from the two Iowa tribes, but also from every organization that we applied for. On the strength of the first film, we got every, and this is unusual for us too, but we got every grant that we applied for. So it just seemed like everything fell into place, and it's really been a joy to return to that story and to hopefully kind of complete it.
I'd kind of like to add to that the first film, we really kind of planned for that to be broadcast on PBS stations, so we were looking at a one-hour format. And what we decided, once we decided we were going to do this, it really gave us an opportunity to visit these incredible stories that we were not able to include in the first film.
So the first film, as you mentioned, covered the period between 1700 and 1837. Tammy, tell me about the second film. What's the focus of that film?
The focus of the second film will begin in 1837 when the Iowa are removed from their ancestral homelands in the state of Iowa to the reservation in Kansas and Nebraska. And then we take that story all the way to 1878 when there's a split in the tribe, and part of the Iowa end up moving to Indian Territory, which is in Oklahoma.
And Kelly, what's the focus of the third film?
The third film picks up the story there, then with the what are called the Southern Iowa in Oklahoma, beginning a new life there, and then we kind of have parallel storylines between the Northern Iowa in Kansas and the Southern in Oklahoma, up through the 1970s or so, and then as we did with the first film, we intercut contemporary stories. Generally, these are efforts by Iowa people to rekindle interest or reclaim heritage or culture in various ways. And so those stories are kind of intercut throughout the film.
And
that's
we have a moment from the second film where you did just that. And let's get a feel for what you're talking about. This is Brett Ramey of the Iowa tribe of Kansas and Nebraska. And in the film, he's out foraging for food on their land.
We have everything from these blackberries here to wild raspberries, pawpaws, wild plums, wild grapes, wild cherries, elderberries, nettles, several different kinds of greens, black walnuts. This is all just in this one little area. I mean, why put all of our effort into growing food when there's already this forest full of food right here? But as much as you can retain those core values in the midst of, you know, being in the middle of 2012, you know, if we can still harvest traditional foods in our reservation and do it in a dignified and respectful way that our ancestors would have, and that's still, to me, a traditional cultural act.
You mentioned with each one of these films a time period that you focus on, but you do work in these modern scenes. We're not just following a chronological trajectory or chronological history of the Iowa people. You're showing us Iowa people as they live today, talking about their culture, efforts to preserve it, or other parts of their lives. Why was that important to you?
Well, I think with all of our films, we do make historical documentaries, but we think that if we can't show connections between the past and the present, then people aren't really so interested in the history. And so much of what happens now is influenced by what has happened in the past, and it is really important to be aware of those things so that we don't continually make the same mistakes over and over again.
The other thing is, with our own storytelling method, we always have a linear thread through the film, which kind of takes us through the history. But by going and visiting these present-day segments, we're able to get, I think, a better view of the whole story of the Iowa. And also, we have to, I think it's important that we don't just, you know, keep the Iowa in the past. You know, they are very much here and succeeding and thriving, and so that was important to us as well.
Well, and speaking of the people who help you tell the story of the Iowa, I want to bring Lance Foster into the conversation. He is an Iowa artist and scholar who lives in Montana. Hello, Lance.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for being with us today.
And glad to be here.
Were you involved in the making of the first documentary as well, or is this a new project for you?
Yeah, I've been along for the entire ride, pretty much.
And you, in the films, you do a lot to help tell the story of the Iowa people. Why is it important for you to understand this history?
Well, you know, as you'll see in the film, I mean, the whole story of the Iowa is somewhat, it's kind of a diaspora, people scattered, you know, the succeeding waves of challenges. And my own family had to leave the reservation during World War II to find work and ended up in California first and then gradually moved to Montana. And I would say most of the Iowas, enrolled Iowas, at least in the northern part, don't even live on the reservation anymore. We're scattered to the winds, you know. And so most of us are always trying to find a way to reconnect and a way to understand who we are, that big part of who we are, you know.
Well, let's go back to where this second film picks up, and this is when the Iowa were removed to Kansas. And this is a story that's quite typical of a lot of the Native American tribes or the Native American groups, in that they were moved to their to a reservation, to land supposedly set aside by the government of the United States for them. And Kelly and Tammy, you don't just focus on that removal, but you also focus on the individuals in the Iowa tribe who were doing the negotiations of these treaties, and a young chief who was put in a position of terrific responsibility in taking over. Why was it important to you to make sure that these individual stories were told?
I think to some degree an audience responds well to particular characters. And because that's how, in a way, we see the story through their eyes as the audience. And it's a little less easy to do that as time moves forward. But there are these people who sort of stand out in history, and it's really hard for us to imagine now the difficult choices that they faced. There were choices to be made about whether to resist what the government was doing or whether to acquiesce. And either way, in a sense, wasn't a good option. I mean, there were just very difficult choices, and the effect. It's hard to measure the effect that it had on them personally as well. But it is interesting. I think more interesting to tell a story, hopefully, through the eyes of some of the people who may have been direct participants.
Tell me about White Cloud, the young White Cloud, who ended up becoming chief of the tribe after his father was killed.
Well, actually, I would very much like to hear Lance talk about Frank White Cloud. I think he and I both, and Tammy also, find him a very interesting figure.
Lance, and we'll get started here. We'll have to take a break, and then we'll continue.
So he was right there during the entire change. I mean, this was a guy who took over from his father's death when he was still just a boy. Essentially a boy had been sent to an Indian school under Father De Smet when he was just a child, St. Regis. And so he was acquainted with the whole white world from the get-go. And when he started out as a young man, he was, like young people are, very interested in change and how do you deal with that, and very engaged and positive. But that would change as the years went on.
All right. Well, we'll find out how he changed and how that changed the future of the Iowa people in a moment. We're talking this hour about the Iowa people. Filmmakers Kelly and Tammy Rundle of Fourth Wall Films are premiering parts 2 and 3 of their documentary, Lost Nation, the Iowa, this weekend in Iowa City. I'm talking with them, and I'm also talking with Lance Foster, an Iowa artist and scholar. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Iowa people. That's, of course, the group of people who gave this state their name. The story of these people is the subject of a series of documentaries called Lost Nation, the Iowa, from filmmakers Kelly and Tammy Rundle of Fourth Wall Films. Parts 2 and 3 of the documentary will premiere in Iowa City tomorrow at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History. You can find out more about that event on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Kelly and Tammy Rundle are here with me today. And also with me is Lance Foster. He's an Iowa artist and scholar who lives in Montana. And Lance, right before the break, we were talking about how this time when the Iowa people were forced off their ancestral lands, their native lands, and moved to Kansas, around the same time, a young chief had to take over. He was only in his early 20s, and he'd been educated amongst white people, and they had given him the name Francis, so his traditional name was White Cloud, just like his father, and he was referred to as Frank White Cloud because of the two cultures really coming together in him. But he faced so many challenges as he took over. Was he surrounded by advisors, or was this something he had to take on his own?
Well, definitely he had his uncle, No Heart, who was always there to advise him. And, you know, the chiefs were never just like the main guy. They were almost like the mouth of the people traditionally. All the people, you know, would filter through the chief.
And what were his responsibilities? Of course, at this time, it was more than leading his people, keeping his community together. He also had to negotiate with the U.S. government.
Right. And the U.S. government really only wanted one head chief in any given tribe. The traditional structure of any tribe usually had a council of older men, and there'd be maybe dozens of people who traditionally would make decisions. But that's kind of messy when you're dealing with a government. You know, they want one guy to go to. So based partly upon White Cloud's hereditary position as a senior, you know, member in the Bear Clan, but also because he kind of pulled for the Americans during the World War, during the War of 1812, whereas a lot of the Iowas went on the British side, the Americans were glad to kind of denote him as the main head chief. And so they started putting the pressure on White Cloud.
When the Iowa had to leave their native lands, where did they go?
Well, they gradually had filtered from prehistoric times from the north and northeast, Wisconsin and Iowa and all those areas, and pushed by some of the wars between the Sioux and the Sac and Fox. They gradually found themselves in northern Missouri as being their central area, where earlier had been one of the cognate tribes, the Missouria, whose area they had kind of gone into. And so they conflicted with Osage down there. But that was it. I mean, that was the last part of their, actually their first land cession wasn't even their ancestral lands. It was down in northern Missouri.
And when they were giving up this land, in a way, they were almost tricked. Well, they were tricked into giving up this land. But they had acquired these debts in their dealings with the U.S. government, so they had to, quote, sell this land to pay off their debts.
Well, it's kind of like the whole student loan thing these days, you know. I mean, people think they get painted into a corner, and then all of a sudden they find themselves, holy criminy, what the heck do I do now, you know? And that's what the white people wanted. You know, the British and French not so much, but the Americans, they were expanding. They needed land, and they found a way to pressure people into it.
Kelly and Tammy, in the second part of your series, in the part two of your documentaries, you focus on when the missionaries arrived and started ministering to the Iowa people. Something that was very interesting about those early missionaries was that they actually learned the Iowa language. They translated the Bible into Iowa. They communicated with the Iowa in their own language, which is not, I think, a typical idea that many of us would have of missionaries coming to the people. Were you surprised to learn about that?
Yeah, it was surprising. As you say, it was generally the other way around, that Native people were discouraged from speaking their language. So, yeah, their efforts, in a way, helped to preserve the Iowa language. And there are other examples, I guess, of, you know, a lot of the folks that, in a way, helped to destroy Native American culture, many of them thought they were doing the right thing. In many cases, they obviously weren't doing the right thing, but many of them thought they were. And of course, the motivation for using the language wasn't to preserve the language. It was to more effectively proselytize the Native people they were working with.
Although, as you mentioned, this early effort really, in a way, has helped to preserve the language. Of course, tactics changed over time. The missionaries changed their tactics. There were many different kinds of missionaries, but then there were also the agents of the government. And as time went on, children were taken away from their families, from their reservations, and sent to Indian school. Lance, can you tell us what you know about that time when the children started to be taken away and sent to boarding schools?
Well, early on, when the missionaries first started operating in Iowa land, most of the kids that went there were either a few sons of the chief or orphans mainly. And later on, for example, in the 1880s through the early 1900s, they were sent to places like described in the film. my grandmother went to one of the Indian boarding schools. It was so rough and so unpleasant that finally she was able to get her father to come and steal her away.
Well, in the second film, Tammy and Kelly, you do visit an Indian school. Tell us about the school that you visited us. Tammy?
We went to Genoa, Indian boarding school in Genoa, Nebraska. We actually took a trip with two IOA tribal members from Kansas and Nebraska and met up with a third one there. And they had relatives that were schooled there. And part of the film, a segment in the film, has to do with that. And it was actually a really incredible segment to do and to kind of experience it through their eyes. They were visiting for the first time. They were looking at documents that had to do, I believe it was with Annie's mother who attended, and just kind of hear the story of what took place there and what those children had to go through and the loss of their culture and their language and all of the changes that were experienced.
Let's listen to a moment from the film. This is Annie. Is it Annie Assetta?
Yes.
And Lyle Curlian.
Curlin.
All right. And these are their reflections after their visit.
It seems like it was designed along the lines of a prison or military. I mean, there was certainly amount of discipline and control. I feel bad for the kids that had a hard time here, and some that never got over it. I'm grateful my mother did.
And the story she told about the grandson, and when he got home, he couldn't talk to his grandfather because he'd forgot his language. But it should have been the other way around, but it wasn't, so they should have been made to learn our language to be accepted in our world, but that's another story too.
I still, you know, feel bad for what she went through, and I honor her for that.
I told Annie that all the talking that we did yesterday just brought back memories and things to me that I'd outlived many, many years ago and don't want them back in my head, you know. But they were back there for that day, but they'll go again. And some things are just better forgotten.
Some things are better forgotten. Did it take convincing to convince these people to actually visit the Indian school?
Well, this is an example of, you know, one of the interesting things that we get to do, you know, as our sort of regular line of work. And it was interesting because this was not anything that we had anything to do with, in the sense that these folks were back for the powwow in the fall of the year that we did the filming, and they had planned this kind of excursion, I guess, after the powwow. And the purpose, I think, was to kind of compare the reality of the place with the stories that they had been told by their parents. And so, as Lyle indicated, he needed a little bit of convincing that he should even go up there. And it was just interesting to be with them. And we did not only the school, but we did some traveling around in the area to some other sites that had connections to their families. And it was just a really interesting day that we spent up there.
This is kind of the case with the story. One of the wonderful things about the IOA films is that we've had an opportunity to talk to so many different people, like Lance and Annie and Lyle, and, you know, different historians, and the IOA people have been very willing to talk to us and have been open and candid with us on camera, and we've been really appreciative of that. It has made for a richer film experience because of that.
Lance, watching this experience, visiting the Indian school and revisiting this very dark and difficult time in the past of your people, is that difficult for you?
Well, you know, the Highland school there is right on the reservation, and the Highland reservation is was even before Genoa, so it's still haunted by shadows. For me, you can feel the sadness in the brick, that's for sure.
A lot of this second film focuses on preservation of the language today. We get to see people who are working hard to keep the Iowa language alive. Lance, you're working hard to tell the stories of the Iowa people and also, of course, to express yourself as an artist as well. But what do you think is the most important thing for the rest of us to know about the Iowa people today?
We are an example. We are, for people in Iowa, we are important to understand your land and your history and the roots of how everything came to be. But in a larger sense, I think the films kind of show this, and I think Tam and Kelly would agree with this. We're an example of dozens of kinds of tribes who disappeared or were fragmented. The thing is to remember every bit of the Americas was owned by some Indian people before white contact. And it's not just the West with the Navajo and the Sioux. Every square inch of this land is soaked in our memory. And I think that's one thing that the film's important to other people to understand. That they actually, you know, we're just an example of many.
Yeah, one of the historians in the film put it in wonderful perspective, saying that there were Native people on this land for 20,000 years. There have been white settlers, white people on this land for 500 years at the most. Just a blip in time in the history of this land in many ways. Lance, the language of the Iowa people, like so many of these native languages, has been lost in many ways. Although, as I mentioned, those early missionaries wrote a lot of things down, which has helped preserve the language. And there are linguists in the film who talk about the fact that we have all the pieces. We can hear it. We can say it. We can teach people to speak the Iowa language. Do you speak Iowa?
I speak some. I've been working on it for probably 20, 30 years, you know, little bits and pieces here, trying to sew it back together. So, that means I speak Iowa.
What does it mean to you to not have this native language of your people be a native language of yours?
Well, the key for me, I was raised in Montana, and I was raised mainly around Blackfeet, Cheyenne people who were able to keep, you know, their time in history with contact was much later than ours. So, and they were a larger group of people, and so they maintained their language much better than we did. But I learned from one of my uncles in the Cheyenne tribe, Herman Bear, comes out, that the language is the key for being Indian. If you know your language, that's what shapes you as an Indian. And so that became my priority more than, say, powwow dancing or art or anything, to learn something about our language. And up here, there's nobody to talk to. So I talk to the mountains, you know. I say, which means, you know, the dark clouds are coming when I see a storm, you know. Or I see a deer and I go, aho, tarika, how are you, deer? And the deer will stop and listen to you.
Let's listen to another moment from the film. This is linguist Jimmy Goodtracks, and he is working hard to make sure that the language is passed on.
When my little grandson came to me as a baby, I said, everybody talks about learning the language and teaching their kids. So I just started talking to my baby grandson. And when he emerged at age 2.5 and 3, he emerged speaking Bajo Jijiwere as his first language.
Lance, you mentioned how the Iowa people are scattered. You're in Montana, of course, as in this modern world, people move everywhere. I'm sure there are Iowa people all over this nation. Of course, there is a group of Iowa people living in Kansas and Nebraska, and another part of the Iowa people split off, and they live in Oklahoma. There are people like you preserving the history. There are people working on preserving the language. How do you feel right now about the state of the Iowa people?
Oh, it's so much better than it was, you know, say 20, 30 years ago, I think. I mean, we, like you said, we have so many people working hard trying to bring back things. I mean, to have a documentary about us, to have people know about us. When I was going to school at Iowa State for my graduate degree, I had an anthropology professor from the University of Iowa over there say, you know, I'm glad to hear about you guys because I had started doing our web stuff. She said, I've been teaching for a long time. You guys were extinct, you know?
Wow. How does it feel to watch these films?
It's for me, it's gratifying. It's great to see some of the people I haven't seen in person for so long, you know, and some people who have passed on now, you know, who are gone. So I really wish sometimes that we had film a long time ago so I could see my great-grandparents or some of those old chiefs, you know. I mean, wouldn't that be something?
Oh, that would be amazing. Lance, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You bet. Thank you very much. Warigrohi.
Lance Foster.
I mean, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Lance Foster is an Iowa artist and scholar. He's featured in the documentaries of filmmakers Kelly and Tammy Rundle. Their company is called Fourth Wall Films, and they have produced a three-part documentary called Lost Nation, the Iowa. Parts two and three of that documentary will have their world premiere in Iowa City tomorrow at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we're focusing on the Iowa people, the people who gave our land their name. They're also the people who are the focus of a series of three documentaries called Lost Nation, the Iowa. The first documentary came out almost 5 years ago, and it has been shown widely. It's won many awards, but it also inspired the filmmakers behind it to follow up with two more documentaries, and they will premiere this weekend in Iowa City. With me, the filmmakers, Kelly and Tammy Rundle of Fourth Wall Films. And also in the studio with us now is Lynn Alex. She is the Education and Outreach Program Director for the Office of the State Archaeologist. And Tammy, tell me first, in the film, we see this group of archaeologists, many of them who work very close to me, actually, in Iowa City, in the same building, out excavating a site of an Iowa village. Where is this village?
The village site, this is Iowa village site. It's near Selma, Iowa, I guess you would say, near Iowaville. What would you say, Kelly, down?
Well, yeah, I mean, Eldon is maybe the town that people would know
right. The
best, and it's on the Des Moines River.
And it's a remarkable place. We were very excited to be able to get out there and film this first excavation of this very historic and significant part of Iowa history. And Lynn was out there at the time. We got some footage of her as well. She'll see herself in the film.
So you've said.
Right. Well, and this site was first discovered, what, in 1970?
Well, at least by the professional community, of course. Other people have known about it for a long time. But I think it was first recorded in 1971, or first documented as an archaeological site by a professional. But up until the excavations that Telly and Cammy refer to, there had been no professional excavations at the site. So that's fairly new and was a very exciting project for all of us.
What took so long?
Well, the site's on private land. So there is the issue of getting permission to do a site like that. As much as we'd like to go out and research every wonderful site that we know about, there is also the issue of the interest, the research design, the cost of doing a project. And so it kind of had to have those things come together. The person that was in charge of the project is right next door, and that's Cindy Peterson. And Cindy is very interested in this contact period, American Indian history at the contact period. And so she has had a concerted research effort the last few years to get out to some of these places like Iowaville. And so Cindy sort of pulled that all together, and the results were amazing.
Had this land been under cultivation?
It had. It has been under cultivation probably for a long time. There are, however, a lot of local folks in the area who knew about the site, who had been collecting at the site for many years, even some folks who would go out with metal detectors. And so some of the private collections from the site have remarkable artifacts in them, nested metal pots, for instance, just wonderful items. And I was able to go down a few years ago at the time of the first premiere, the premiere of the first film, with some of the Iowa tribal members who came north for the film, including Jim Goodtracks and his little grandson. And so to hear him speaking, and his little grandson was not too far off, having just emerged, as he said, in speaking Iowa at the time. And that was really special to be down on the site with them.
Oh, yes. Well, how much, obviously there are artifacts buried under right. this land, but when looking at the film, I could see that the location of lodges, for example, had been plotted out. How much can you know from this land that's been a farm field for a really long time?
Well, that was part of the reason that Cindy did this project, and that was to try to get us an idea of what might lie beneath yet at this site, because it had been plowed for a long time. It had been collected for a long time. There's a road that runs at the across part of the site. And so she was able to go out there with fairly minimal ground disturbance. There was some test excavation that was done, but the National Park Service was able to loan us one of their scientists, and he came over with some geophysical techniques that basically let you see what might lie beneath the ground without really doing excavation. And as a result of her test excavations and those geophysical mapping results, we know that there is quite a bit left. It's good news, because there's a lot that's still beneath the ground. There are probably lodges there. There are certainly storage pits that are there. And there's some very enigmatic circles of about 60 and 80 feet in diameter, meters in diameter.
Big.
That may represent enclosures of some sort. So everybody was quite excited with the results.
I think a lot of us, because of images that we saw on television growing up, that kind of thing, we have sort of a stereotypical image of what Native Americans' settlements looked like. But the images that I see, the renderings, the drawings on this film show me that it's not at all like I would imagine. Right. So can you paint a picture for us a little bit of how the Iowa people would have lived in a settlement like that?
Well, I'm doing some surmising, because we don't yet know from this particular site, but we do have other sites where we have evidence of structures of the houses that were built. And sometimes there are enclosures around some of these Iowa-related sites, or sites we think that are Iowa-related. There would have been a lot of storage pits, both inside the houses probably and outside.
And these houses, structures, would they have been wooden structures?
Yeah, we suspect that these were probably, and there were probably houses that varied depending on the season. So there could have been houses that were, for certain seasons, that were basically timber-based structures, but the coverings might have varied depending on the season of the year.
So thatch, possibly?
Well, probably hides, but probably a matting during certain times of the year over an oval-type structure. At other times of the year, you might have had bark covering the houses themselves. We don't know yet for Iowaville. It was a site where people were living in the late 1700s, early 1800s. This is a time when there's a lot of trading going on, and a lot of the artifacts that are known from the site are trade items. The Iowa were probably positioned at this location at that time to take advantage of some of that trade. And so we're seeing basically a community that's got international fingers, in a sense, because of the trade goods that are coming in from the British, of course, from the Americans, to some extent, even from Spanish traders at that time period.
Although, as Kelly and Tammy point out in the film, a lot of the archaeological record from that time shows us that they were still planting native crops.
Absolutely. I don't want to give a misrepresentation. They were planting, they were gathering, they were still hunting. A lot of the bone that was found at Iowaville is deer bone, and that's probably because they were trading in deer hides. So absolutely, they have a self-contained economy that that is enhanced perhaps somewhat with trade. And we think that there's sort of more, I wouldn't say exactly control, but the Iowa themselves are making some decisions that perhaps in the past we used to think was more under the control of the traders coming in. But they're affecting some of the things that are happening at this time period as well.
Kelly, it strikes me that at the time when you were making the first film, and of course continuing on to the second and third film, it's a time when archaeologists, when anthropologists are still learning a great deal about the Iowa people. There's a lot that we don't know, isn't there?
I think that's right. And Lance talked about the people being scattered to the four winds, and I think in some ways the history of the Iowa has been scattered. And in even just casually surfing the internet once in a while, as we're looking for something, we'll find an item tucked away somewhere that we didn't realize was there, and then there's another piece maybe to the puzzle. But yeah, I think this discovery that people do, I admire people who do archaeology, because in a way, it seems to me they have the ability to walk around this and to see what was, rather than you or I who see what is.
Later in the second film, there is another settlement that that you take a look at, and it's on the border of Iowa and South Dakota. Blood Run is the name of this area, and there are a number of mounds in this area, and I don't know if maybe you can shed a little light on, because I know that the mounds in eastern Iowa, we don't really understand the history of effigy mounds, and we don't really know much about the mound builders. But do we have an idea, and maybe Lynn, you're the person to ask, do we have an idea of what relationship the Iowa people may have had to the mound builders?
I would say that that the short answer is that directly we probably don't. Not in terms. Well, I would say it depends on the mounds. You mentioned effigy mounds. Effigy mounds were probably last constructed around AD 1200. The site that you're referring to, I believe, is the Blood Run site, and that is a site that at its heyday was probably 1500 to 1700 AD. That's a site that is a remarkable site. It is a National Historic Landmark. We know about it from a lot of oral history from groups of people like the Iowa, like the Omaha, Ponca, and Oto. All of those people seem to have had a major presence at Blood Run. It does have mounds, and we know from past disturbance largely that many of those mounds were burial mounds. And the site has a lot of trade goods. That site is also on some of the earliest French maps that we have for this part of the world. So it's a site that's a wonderful example of how we know comes not only from American Indian history, oral history, but also from early documents as well as archaeology.
And that's a time in the film, Tammy, when I really felt an urgency. So much of the film shows us the history, and yes, in looking at the efforts to preserve the language and the stories of the Iowa people, I felt an urgency on the part of the Iowa people who are trying to hold on to their culture. But at that point in the film, I felt an urgency for all of us to make sure that these sites that remain are preserved. Was that your goal?
Well, I think at heart, Kelly and I are preservationists, and so we do see the importance of trying to preserve sites. And I think because of the people that we've worked with on all of our films, we tend to, I guess we do kind of bring that out in our films. Wouldn't you say so too, Kel?
Yeah, it's not conscious, but I guess that's at the core of it. And certainly that's why one makes a historical documentary. You're trying to preserve some element of the past for future consumption and understanding. But I think there should be a feeling of people who live in Iowa now that this is their history too. European Americans have not been in Iowa for 10,000 years, as our native friends have, but that history is now our history, and we should be just as concerned, hopefully, about preserving some of those sites that are primarily of native historical significance as we are about sites that perhaps honor our pioneer ancestors.
And Lynn, I'm sure in archaeology it's always a race against time, but is there a sense of urgency among you and your fellows in archaeology that now is a time when we need to be thinking hard about preserving these sites?
Oh, I would say yes. And I would say that sort of underlies our goals in many cases as well. We learn a lot when we can do research at a site, but the preservation is really important. And sometimes you're preserving it for lots of different reasons, but it's a finite resource. One way or the other, it cannot be duplicated again. And so it is at the heart of a lot of what archaeologists are involved in as well.
I want to play one more moment from the second documentary, and I think that this gets to the heart of preserving these stories. And this is from Bill Green.
You know, stories aren't just stories. You know, among the Iowas, when they were under so much pressure in the early 1800s, the storytelling was part of the survival strategy. I mean, if you didn't know where you came from, you literally could lose your identity. The government would take it away. You know, the survival of the group was at stake. We call them stories. They weren't just stories. They were part of the identity of the people. And so maybe that's one way to think of the difference between, you know, stories that maybe our grandparents might tell us now. You know, what's really at stake? Well, you know, a little family history, you know, so be it. Maybe it's written down, maybe it's not. You know, we're not going to die off if we forget about it. But 200 years ago, it was very different.
Kelly, as these films go out into the world, and of course the first documentary has been out in the world, what is your hope? What do you want them to do?
I think we had the experience that sort of speaks to that question when we showed the film in Los Angeles. Tammy and I spent 18 years living in Los Angeles, and we returned for the first time after moving back to the Midwest to show Lost Nation the Iowa at a Native American film series in downtown L.A., and the film didn't play any differently there than it did in the Midwest. And afterward, a Japanese-American man came up to me, and he said, I love the film and the event here tonight. And he said, I saw my own family's experience during World War II being placed in internment camps. I saw that story in this film. And I think the reason that the first film has been well-received is because it's not just a Native American story. It's a human story. And as people watch our films, I hope, and Tammy and I both hope, that people will see someone in that film that they recognize, even if they don't really know that person, but they've met someone like that. They've been in that situation. They understand how that person feels. I think that's why it has been successful.
Tammy, do you want to add to that?
I think he pretty well summed it up. This has been, for us, I would say probably Iowa 2 and 3 has been an extremely emotional journey for us. Iowa 1 was a wonderful and rewarding experience, but I think these two films, this whole project, we've been taking this journey, walking the paths of the Iowa, walking over their lands and reading their history, absorbing their stories, and learning so much about them. And it has been a life-changing experience for us. And I guess I'm just hoping that when people sit down and see the film, that they not only learn about the Iowa, but they learn something about themselves. And they acknowledge that these people, you know, really gave so much. And that there is so much to be learned, and that we should recognize what has what this culture has given to all of us.
Tammy and Kelly Rundle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Lynn Alex, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Lynn Alex is the Education and Outreach Program Director for the Office of the State Archaeologist, and Kelly and Tammy Rundle are documentary filmmakers. Their film company is called Fourth Wall Films, and they have now completed three documentaries, a series of documentaries called Lost Nation, The Iowa, Parts 2 and 3 of their documentary will premiere in Iowa City tomorrow at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History. You can find more information on our Facebook page. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.